everybody. My name is Gail, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, this place is full. What a beautiful sight. I want to thank Bob for inviting me back to this conference. It is truly my favorite conference, and not just because of the great speakers that are here, but because of the spirit that you bring to Stateline. But it's really not Stateline anymore, but we'll still call it Stateline. I want to thank Christine. Thank you so much for the picking me up at the airport, which was pretty heroic, actually, getting through all that traffic and everything. You've been a wonderful hostess, and thank you so much. And whoever is responsible for the basket that was in the room, great job this year. I've already packed some up for the ride home. It'll get me on that long plane ride back home. We were talking. Bob, I want to thank you, Linda, and Peter, for the recovery that you brought us today. It is truly the hero's journey, and I thank you all for taking it. Very moving. And as I was talking to Bob earlier, this little gal came up, she said, "Oh, I'm just in heaven. Where else can you get AA and gambling at the same time?" And I thought, well, I don't know about you, sweetie, but where else can you get AA and cowboys at the same time? I know they got that little chapel ready. If I find me a sober bull rider, long legs, tight jeans, and boots, that's my kind of guy. But that's not what we're here for, so we will try and keep first things first. Many people this weekend are going to tell their story, parts of their story, and I am honored that I get to tell our story. This conference is sort of dedicated to Bill Wilson and his birthday, which would have been in November 26th. If he were still living today, he'd be 117 years old. So happy birthday, Bill. And you'll get to hear him. If my mojo's working and I bring him back from the dead, maybe he'll speak to us today. By the way, over on the right-hand corner there, it's just kind of a collage of pictures from Akron. I just want to tell you that they have torn down King's School. I know. And we care more about it than most of the people in Akron, even the alumni there. I think they're selling bricks. If you get a chance, you might want to call our office and get a number, maybe get a brick from the school. My story starts out with a little qualifying. This is a conference that is often referred to as Woodstock, so I think this picture is pretty appropriate. That is not Woodstock. That is Slade, Kentucky, where I was drunk on that blanket. You see a half a gallon of wine to my right. You see a cigarette in my hand and a deck of cards in the other. And yes, my zipper is down. I'm happy to report to you that my sobriety date is May 13th, 1978, when I was privileged to get sober in Akron, Ohio, the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm grateful. And the picture following that is a picture of me in a blackout. Could be you. And I'd just like to share with you how I ended up being a historian, archivist, storyteller in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because I was always told to do whatever you're asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The old-timers passed that on. And I got to be a hostess for Founders Day. And at that time, you know, Bill used to come up often back to Akron for Founders Day. And after he passed in 71, Lois continued that tradition. And I was asked to seat Lois and her companions. And one of the companions was Nell Wing. And it was at a breakfast, and there happened to be an empty seat. And I sat down next to Nell. And she was going to get me an autographed book of Lois's. And Lois, remember, had just come out. And I was so grateful for that, and I said, "Oh, Nell, thank you so much. And if there's ever anything I can do for you, just ask." Well, watch when you say that in Alcoholics Anonymous, because somebody's going to ask you to do something. And she did. She said, "Gail, I'd like you to start an archives." And I thought, "Oh, my God, what's that?" A bunch of smelly old papers in Washington, D.C. was about all I knew. But and then I thought, well, where would we put it? How in the world would we do it? Akron, up to that time, this was about 1984, really hadn't done much. We had Founders Day, but you could drive by Dr. Bob's house, and the hippies on the porch would throw beer bottles at you. But so anyway, I ended up getting involved in the negotiating the purchase on Dr. Bob's home, and I ran off to New York, and I said, okay, Nell, we have the house. I can put the archives now in the house. But I wanted to be an AA archivist. And she said, Gail, if you want to be an AA archivist, you can't put AA in the house. AA can't own property. And I spent the next 3 days whining, trying to talk her out of our traditions. But she did train me in the difference between a foundation and the structure of AA. And after 10 years of wandering around trying to drum up interest in archives, our office invited me down in 1995, gave me an old dump of a room and said, would you put the archives in this room? And if you get a chance, please visit the archives, 775 North Main Street, and you'll find your archives under your structure in our office. Currently, though, I'm back on the board of Dr. Bob's house, and I'm serving there as well. So thank you, Nell. Nell was a friend of Bill and Lois's. She was a secretary to Bill, and she later became our first archivist. Bill wanted to make sure that this story didn't become myth, and so we want to keep the record straight. And so thank you, Nell. And here is a little clip of my visit when Nell trained me. You know, it's really hard to be an archivist in an anonymous organization, so you need to know a little bit about the traditions as well. And so there's Nell, and the picture's taken at Stepping Stones, and here's a picture of me having a drink with Lois. And I'd like to say in that picture, I am sober, but my hair hadn't sobered up yet. It's pretty unmanageable, actually. And now for what we came for, the history of the writing of the Big Book. And I'd like to take you back in time here to downtown Akron as it appeared when Bob and Bill would be in downtown. Dr. Bob's office was in downtown Akron. And just a little history of how this birth took place. The Firestones were like royalty. You know, they had lots of money and lots of power and lots of influence. And they had a son, second from the right. His name was Russell. His nickname was Bud. And he was a terrible alcoholic. And I'd like to say all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put that kid back together again, because money can't buy sobriety. And power can't buy it either. So the father had just given up hope on the son. And we're here to, this story to me is about slender threads. And one of those threads has to do with Jim Newton on the left. He was a young luggage salesman, and I believe God can use womanizers because he used Jim. He was chasing pretty girls in Massachusetts, and he thought he was on his way following him into a hotel to a singles dance, but he ended up at an Oxford group meeting. And he became a great grouper, and he ended up down in Florida in Fort Myers, and he was helping Thomas Edison develop real estate. And Harvey Firestone was a good friend of Thomas Edison and would visit down there, and took a liking to Jim and brought him to Akron to groom him for a big position in the company. And Jim became friends with Russell, Bud Firestone, and knew he had a bad drinking problem, even went away to treatment with him one time, jogged with him and did all that. That was before we knew about codependency and prior to Al-Anon. And it didn't take, but he talked him into going on a train trip to Denver where the Oxford group was meeting. And on the way there, Bud gave up the flask, and there was some controlled drinking. Jim controlled it. And on the way coming back, this is a real small world, Sam Shoemaker was on that train. And they pulled Bud into a train car, and Bud made a surrender in that train car. It was called soul surgery back then. And when he got off in Akron, he didn't look the same anymore. They said the lines on his forehead were gone. And the father just couldn't believe it. And so if you know a little bit about the story of the prodigal son, this story parallels that story, where the son returns home and he's sober and the father is so grateful. And Frank Buchman, who was the founder of the Oxford group, was invited to Akron by the Firestones And this was high society. This was a very big event. Now, if you were down and up, you went to the Oxford group. If you were down and out, you went to the Salvation Army. And so all the uppers of Akron came to pick him up. You know, long gowns, all of society, big dinner that they held. And you can see there that some of the headlines. That's Harvey Firestone there on the left. And they're going to hold this meeting. The first one was a dinner for about 400. And who gives testimony to his recovery from alcohol but Bud Firestone? And that's important. And you're going to see as I tell this story why it's important. When you look at the two cities, Akron and New York, it gets started in Akron because of a drunk's recovery. And what they do is they're going to have a dinner, and then they're going to, for the next 10 days, they're going to have what they called house parties, meetings. And they held them in the morning and at night, and they went out on Sundays into the pulpits of the churches. And what was happening is, I believe, God was preparing the soil for this birth. And at this time that they were throwing these house parties, Henrietta Seiberling on the left and Ann Smith on the right got involved. And Dr. Bob was on his way down. He had didn't have many friends. Things weren't going too well for him. And these two women had a lot of power over Bob, probably through guilt maybe a little bit. But they manipulated him, and they manipulated him to coming to an Oxford group meeting, and he liked it. Probably much like when you walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of laughter, a lot of fellowship, and he needed that, and so he joined the Oxford group. That doesn't mean he got sober. They read a lot of books. Bob read those. He read the Bible. He even went back to church, something he swore he would never do. But even though he had every principle that we have today, Bob wouldn't get sober in 2.5 years. And I leave you to ponder why. Why, if you had all the principles that we have today, would you not get sober? Well, Henrietta Seiberling gets a tip from Delphine Weber, who calls her up and says, "What are we going to do about Dr. Bob?" And she says, "What do you mean, what are we going to do about Dr. Bob?" He said, "Well, he's not sharing, and Ann, neither one of them share at the meetings at all." And so Henrietta did what they did back then. She put a prayer and a meditation into her quiet time. And the way that would go is you'd get up in the morning and you'd open the Bible or a meditation book and you'd say a prayer for a few minutes, and then you'd stop and you'd go into listening, and that would be your quiet time for what God would say to you, and then you would write that down. And after you wrote that down, you would call someone up and you would check it against the four absolutes. So that's what she did. She went into prayer for Dr. Bob, and she got guidance. And her guidance told her to call a special meeting for Dr. Bob and Ann. And today, we would think of that as intervention. But they didn't have that on TV back then. So that came straight in 1935 from her guidance. And so she calls up her friends T. Henry and Clarice Williams, who owned this beautiful Tudor home. Now, he was a tire mold inventor. And he's actually going to lose his job because of Bill's proxy takeover fight. He comes to Akron to take over National Rubber Machinery Shop, and this guy was working for them. And they were about ready to lose their home, just like they're foreclosing on homes. Well, this was Depression times. And they stopped just short of taking this home, the banks did. So they considered this God's house. And so when Henrietta said, "We'd like to use your house for a special meeting," they said, "Okay." Now, there were two meetings. The first meeting was on Monday, and that was called a setup meeting. And Henrietta called that meeting, and she said, "Come prepared to mean business. There's not going to be any pussyfooting around. We're going to share, and we're going to share deeply." That's what they do at interventions. And so on Wednesday at 8 o'clock, they met in this living room, and we have no recording of what they said, those little down and uppers. What, they touched the stove and said a four-letter word? I have no idea what they shared. But when it came Dr. Bob's turn, there was this long pause. And he looked up at them and he thanked them. And then he said, "Now at the cost of my profession, I have something I want to share with you. I am a secret drinker and I cannot stop." And they said, Bob, would you like us to pray for you? And he said, yes. And they all get down on their knees in this living room, and they're going to pray for Bob. Henrietta will continue to pray for him as well. And in fact, one time she, it was right after this, she calls up Ann, and she goes, Ann, I got guidance for Bob. I got guidance for Bob. Bob jumps in his car and rolls down the street and pulls into Henrietta's and says, Henry, what is it? And she goes, Bob, don't touch a single drop of alcohol. That was her guidance. Bob was a little disappointed in that. He kind of thought it would be a bigger miracle than that. But we know the simple truth in that. So shortly after that prayer was said, Bill's going to arrive by train. And he's going to find himself in Akron at the Mayflower Hotel. And you know the rest of the story. There'll be that famous phone call, and the men will get together. And, you know, Bob doesn't have much sobriety when they call on number three guy, Bill D. And I think it's really cool that on July 4th of 1935, Bill is going to walk out of the hospital a free man to never drink again. That's what it says in his story in the big book. So the next time you see fire in the sky, remember that's our Independence Day too, because that's what the big book says is when group number one began. And that little group number one, they didn't have, when they approached Bill or when they 12-stepped each other, they didn't have the 12 steps. They had four words. And Dr. Bob said that the four absolutes were the only yardsticks that we had back then until Bill writes the big book. And those four words are honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And when you wanted to test your guidance, you ran it past these four questions. Is what I'm about to think, say, or do right or wrong, true or false, ugly or beautiful, and how does it affect the other guy? We still study those in the Akron and Cleveland area. We call them 12 and 4s. And I remember I cut my teeth on them early in my sobriety as well. Well, now we have a little group that started in Akron, and they would continue to meet at T. Henry's. And they would form a little group there inside that house, and that was called the Alcoholic Squad. And there was another little meeting, and it started basically, Calvary Church was the headquarters of the Oxford group, and Sam Shoemaker was the head of that church. And there was this little annex to the church where they held the meetings. And we can actually go inside and see what a meeting was like when Bill and Lois attended on Thursdays. The problem was, after Bill had his spiritual experience at Towns, and he sees how his experience can benefit others, he wants to work with alcoholics, and that's all he wants to work with. And if he came into an Oxford group meeting, he'd about knock you down looking for another alcoholic. Well, that didn't go over too well with the Oxford groupers. They wanted to be all things to all people. So they started to give Bill and Lois the cold shoulder. And Bill and Lois began in 1937 to begin meetings at their house at Clinton Street. And this is an artist's rendition of Bill greeting folks as they came. So the break from the Oxford group actually came in New York in 1937. We will continue up until the big book is written to stay with our group. Now, so you have the Alcoholic Squad in Akron, and you're going to have the Drunk Squad is what they called that group, or a nameless bunch of drunks in New York. So you only have these two groups at that time. Now, if you know Bill's story, 1 minute he's up, 1 minute he's down. 1 minute business is good, the next minute the market fails and he's broke. Well, in 1937, he's making his comeback, and he's going to stop in at Akron on one of his business trips to visit his good friends, Bob and Ann. Now, he had spent the summer into the fall of 1935 at Ann and Bob's home at 855 Ardmore. And the times had been hard. They didn't know what they had. There were so many failures in the early days. And how many of you have seen the play Bob and Bill? Some of you have seen the drama that takes place at the level of that play. you might have felt what it was like when Abby drank. That had to be really a crushing blow to them in the early days. But anyway, they were sitting around and they were counting noses. By the way, I photoshopped Bill in there because I needed a picture of all three of them together and I didn't have one. And this is actually 1937 when they do this. They count up 40 noses, they said, 40 people sober. And for some reason, that was a magic number to them. And at the moment they came to that number, they realized collectively together that a light had come into the dark world of the alcoholic. And the first thing they did, there was like this moment of ecstasy, and then they bowed their heads in thanksgiving and prayer. And right after that, if you know Bill Wilson, he came up with an idea. He'd been working on Wall Street, and he knew about those chains of drugstores and things, and he said, you know, this was his next idea from that humble moment. He says, oh, we're going to need a chain of hospitals, and we're going to need some missionaries, and we're going to need to write some literature. And so they had learned a little bit about the group conscience this time. They had had that one incident at Towns Hospital. Now remember, this is a depression. This story takes place in some very, very hard times. Our co-founders actually thought that the depression was providential because it brought us together. People really had to work hard, come together to help each other. So anyway, they had discovered, Bill had been offered a job at Towns and he was hungry. And he came running home all excited to Lois and a house full of drunks. And they said, no, Bill, you can't do that to us. You can't become a professional. So Bill had turned that down and at the same time realized that the voice of the group was better than the voice of one. So they decided to try the group conscience out and that they would go over to T. Henry's. Oh, before they do that, I just want to share a little bit here of how the two men thought, because Bob was a little more reserved than Bill. He was tempered Bill often. In fact, Smitty used to say that was Bob's son. That was up to Dr. Bob. AA would have never left Akron. And it was up to Bill Wilson. He'd have franchised it. And it's just kind of a cute story of the two of them. Here you can see what good friends they are and how happy they are in their sobriety. Notice Dr. Bob liked those wild, crazy ties. And he often would have on Argyle socks, and he was quite a character. And I'd love to know what they're saying, but you can just about imagine that Bob is saying, keep it simple, Bill. Don't louse this thing up. And here's Bill. You can see how gregarious he was. And I think film had just came out when this was taken. And in just a moment, you're going to see Ann Smith, the mother of AA. She makes this little brief appearance here, and can you tell? She just wanted to stay in the background. Wasn't happy at all about being filmed. So anyway, like I was saying, they're going to go back over to T. Henry's house, and they're going to Bill's going to pitch him. Being the salesman that he was, he's going to say, he's going to talk to the alcoholic squad, and he's going to say, we need this chain of hospitals, we need some paid missionaries, and we're going to need some literature to keep the message from getting garbled. Now, the alcoholic squad is going to come back, and they're going to say, the man of Galilee had no press agents, newspaper, pamphlets, or book. Keep it simple, Bill. And Bill will say, you know, you can keep it so simple, you'll have anarchy. There's alcoholics dying within gunshot of this house. And I think that was always true of Bill. He was always concerned of the alcoholics that we weren't reaching. And so they put it to a vote. I believe there was 19 men. And with one vote over, it was not unanimity, it was just that one vote that sent Bill back to New York. And they said, well, Bill, if you're going to do this, you better go back to New York and raise the money. They're all broke. So Bill goes back to the Big Apple, and he starts to pitch the rich. But you know what? The rich weren't too interested. 40 drunks sober? That's not a big deal. We'd rather give our money to the Red Cross or the Salvation Army. So Bill couldn't score a dime. And he was back at Clinton Street, and he was whining pretty good about this. And you know what whining is? That's anger coming through a small hole. And Bill got one of those imaginary ulcers that he used to get. And thank God, his sister Dorothy had married a doctor. And that doctor was Leonard Strong, who later became a wonderful friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, but always put the bill for Bill every time he went into town's hospital. So he's in there, and he's whining to Leonard about this, and Leonard felt bad for Bill, and he said, Bill, you know, I think I know of someone who used to be related to the Rockefellers. And he puts in a call to them, and the next thing you know, Bill's talking to Reverend Willard Richardson. Now, he couldn't be talking to a better guy. This was Rockefeller's spiritual advisor and best friend. And so they arranged to meet, and the next thing you know, Bill is on his way up to the 54th floor of the Rockefeller office. And this is where, when he's giving a talk in Texas, he says, on what slender threads our destiny does lie. And I know that's true for all our individual stories as well as this collective story. So there's Bill going from an imaginary ulcer. And that, it's just like when he was down and out in the Mayflower and he's just down to a few dimes. The next thing you know, he's at the Portage Country Club, which is our best country club in Akron. I've only been there one time. And Bill ends up there. And it's just like this story. He goes from an ulcer into the Rockefeller office, and he meets with him, and they set up a meeting for later that year in December, and they're going to have a board meeting. And so let's go into the boardroom, and Mr. Rockefeller had just vacated his chair that Bill sat in, and it was still warm. And Bill said, oh, I'm getting close to the money now. But Bill actually never met the man. But the rest of the board was there. Let's see. There was Albert Scott, Willard Richardson, Leonard Strong, Dr. Silkworth, Frank Amos, and Leroy Chipman. The alcoholics were Bill W., Dr. Bob, Hank, Fitz, Ned, and Dick from Cleveland. Well, they didn't know what to do. I mean, what do? You got a guy's barely sober sitting in the boardroom, Rockefeller's boardroom, and they didn't know what to do, and they started nervously looking at each other. Finally, one of them said, why don't we just do what we do? Why don't we just tell our stories? So they began to tell their recovery stories, and all of a sudden, Albert Scott exclaims, why, this is first century Christianity. And that was really what the Oxford Group was known as when they first started, first century Christians. And then the next thing that gets said is, gentlemen, up to this point, this has been the work of goodwill only. No plan, no property, no paid people, just one carrying the good news to the next. Isn't that true? And may it not be that this is where the great power of this society lies. Well, they didn't want to hear that. They wanted money. They're hungry. Well, Frank Amos was an Ohio boy, and on his own dime, he came to Ohio to check out what was going on. And he found out that Dr. Bob was a pretty good doctor when he was sober. And so he writes up a proposal for $50,000, and they were going to buy down the mortgage on Dr. Bob's home. They're going to get a rehabilitation place and put Dr. Smith in charge, subsidize a few people, start a change of hospitals, and get busy on that book. Well, the paper went across from Richardson to Rockefeller, and Rockefeller says, somehow I'm strangely stirred by all this. I'm going to see if I can get that to slow down. It does that sometimes. But it says, isn't money going to ruin this thing? And there we go. This interests me immensely, but isn't money going to ruin this thing? I'm terribly afraid that it would, and yet I'm so strangely stirred by it all. I sense that possibly a higher power is working there that's doing that strange stirring that he's talking about. So again, they wanted the money, but the money's going to get dwindled down, and they beg. And he says, but he does say, I want to hear what goes on, but please don't bother me for any more money. No, I won't be the one to spoil this thing with money. Now, isn't that something that he would think that? So the 50,000 is going to get shrunk after some begging down to 5,000. And they're going to take the 5,000, and 3,000 of that's going to go to buy down Dr. Bob's home, which only costs 4,000 originally. And that's going to leave the co-founders $2,000, which they're going to put in the Riverside Church, which is Rockefeller's church. And they're going to pull from it as they need it. And that's Harry Emerson Fosdick. Harry Emerson Fosdick is the head of the church, and he's actually going to write the first big book review that will appear in the New York Times. He was quite a friend of AA's as well. He wrote several books that many of the early members chewed their teeth on. So they're going to get this young attorney that was on the Rockefeller side of things, John Wood, and they're going to write up a charter, and they have a question. They're going to call it the Alcoholic Foundation, but they needed to know, what is the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic? And that's the, see, some people got that already. That's the first time I saw that appear, the andas appear. And they decided that an alcoholic is somebody who can't drink and a non-alcoholic is somebody who can. Leonard Strong was the secretary, Richardson was on it, Leroy Chipman was the treasurer, Frank Amos, Dr. Bob Smith was on the board, our first board, Bill R. and Harry B. Bill R. later slipped. Bill Wilson would be on an advisory panel off to the side. And the whole purpose of this was because they still wanted money. So the purpose of this board is to get some money. They've got a little office here where the big book is going to be written. Bill and the first guy, Hank, you're going to meet here. By the way, that office is in New Jersey. They're going to start a car products company. And they're going to hire this darling little gal here, her name's Ruth Hawk, as a secretary. And she was a very good secretary. But she said that she really didn't know what she was getting herself into. One of the reasons was when she would come into the office, somebody would either be passed out or down on their knees. And she said she really didn't see a lot of car products being sold. But anyway, that's, and there she is. That's a picture of her in Pass It On, where Bill actually mentioned she didn't know what she was getting herself into. And that table you're looking at, if you get a chance to visit Stepping Stones, it is the table that Bill and Abby sat down when Abby carried the message to Bill. It's the original table. And so if you can imagine, Bill comes in and he's pacing behind her with a cigarette in his mouth, and he's dictating the book to her. And that's Hank. It was actually Hank's idea to write the book. And in a minute you'll see the outline. He had an idea every minute. We owe him a debt of gratitude as well. We don't talk too much about it. And here's another picture of Ruth. That's actually not her typewriter. I got that from an Al-Anon book with the bottle next to it. But she did get the 5 millionth copy of the big book in Montreal for any of you that were there to see that. And actually, that is the typewriter that she used. Can you imagine today when we have word processors what that must have been like typing up that manuscript? Little did she know, when I first gave this talk, it was in Toronto for our international, and my roommate was Lori. And I said that when Ruth was typing the book, little did she know that the book she was typing, they couldn't afford to pay her. They were giving her the worthless stock certificates. They were ripping her off one a week. That was her ration. But little did she know that the book she was typing would one day save her daughter's life. And I asked Lori to stand. She had about 30 years in Chicago. Love that story. So Bill got a lot of his ideas. They weren't all original. One of them was from William James. He had written in the hospital. He had read Varieties of Religious Experience, which I believe Evie brought him. And that influenced him greatly. And this book, What is the Oxford Group?, which was a textbook for the Oxford Group. And I have to add this little story. I was a couple years sober. And of course, like many of you, I was interested in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was at a harvest festival on the property where the Cyberling Gate Lodge is. And it was not an AA event. It was a harvest festival for the state of Ohio. And they had a tent behind the gate lodge, and it had old books that they were selling. So I went up to the tent and I said, "Do you have any old AA books?" This is 1984. And they said, "No." I said, "Would you have any spiritual books?" And they said, "Yes." There was a little small section, and my hand reached for a little blue book. And it said, "What is the Oxford Group?" And I said, "Gee, I wonder," I barely knew the history back then. Were we the Oxford Group movement or the Oxford Group? I wasn't sure. But when I opened that book, I knew, because it said, R.H. Smith, 855 Ardmore, his book, Please Return. I like to say that the book found me. And this was just right after Nell had asked me to start an archives. So I tried to get them down to a quarter, but I paid 35 cents for that book, and it said, "Please return, you'll find it at Dr. Bob's house." The Common Sense of Drinking was another big one by Richard Peabody. Sermon on the Mount, which is still very popular today and read by many folks, by Emmett Fox. And For Sinners Only by A.J. Russell was another important one. They did a lot of reading. And I must add here, if you read Bill's biography in the big book, you can number every step. And Bill's going to write his biography before he writes chapter 5. And he writes in there what happened at Clinton Street and what happened at Towns Hospital. And if that isn't the most perfect 12-step call, here's Ebby with about 2 months of sobriety, and you can number every step. He brings every step to Bill. Bill will later write them down, but Ebby brings them. And then Bill starts writing the first chapter, which is There is a Solution. Now, he has written an introduction, he's written his biography, and he writes this chapter. And at about that time, and he asks Anne if she would write a chapter to the wives. Now, as you could tell by the video, Anne just likes to stay in the background. So Anne declines, and we've told that Lois got a bit of a resentment because she thought she should write that. And we all know who wrote Chapter to the Wives, don't we? Bill wrote Chapter to the Wives. He decides that he wanted to keep it all in the same style. At least that's what he said. I think Lois did work it out now and on, though. I did. And about this time, they get a hot tip. Somebody gets them in touch with Eugene Exman. Eugene Exman is the religious editor for Harper's Magazine. And Bill's going to take these three documents to Eugene Exman. And he presents them to Eugene, and Eugene reads them and looks them over. Then he looks over at Bill, and he says, "Bill, this is really good. Can you write more like this?" Bill goes, yeah, I can. Now, Bill hadn't done much writing, but, you know, he was really encouraged by that. And he said, "Well, I'm going to give you a $1,500 advance for you to finish this book." Now, remember, Bill's hungry. He doesn't have a job. Lois is supporting everybody. You know, the house is full of drunks. Bill's being a missionary, and Lois is going to work and feeding everybody. So Bill's pretty excited about that offer, and I think this is about when Bill's going to make an appearance here. Yep. Hi, Bill. Bill, I'm glad you could come. This is really kind of an honor of your birthday, and we figured out you'd be 117 years old today, so happy belated birthday, and thanks for coming. We're in Las Vegas, And I'm telling them about the writing of the big book. And I love it when you show up because you do a much better job of it. Would you be willing to share with the folks here?
Now then.
Good.
As a graphic illustration of how pain and fear and all of our worst motives can eventuate under God's grace for the best, I would like to, in a hop, skip, and jump fashion, tell you about the preparation of the AA book.
Thanks, Bill. I was just telling him about Eugene Exman and how he wanted to give you $1,500 so you would finish the book. Did you decide to take that money?
A few of us stood for the proposition, well, this would be bad because control of our literature would be in other hands. And some of us, in a more self-serving way, and this definitely included me, we felt that the book might make some profits and some royalties. Some of us in New York considered the possibility of publishing this book ourselves.
Well, what did you decide to do?
So then we went up to the Reader's Digest and told them about our budding movement, and I guess we brandished Mr. Rockefeller's name pretty liberally, you know, as a close friend. He wasn't giving us any money, but he liked us.
Well, how did that work for you, Bill?
The Digest said, well, fine. When will your book come out? By now, it's the fall of 38. Oh, we said about next spring. They said, this is just the kind of story that we'd like. We will do a piece. We'll put a feature writer on this.
Well, Bill, you'd really never done much writing, and now you got to finish the book. Did you have some fears? And if you did, what were they?
Who would publish such a book? Who could assemble such a book? What should go in it? Supposing it turned out badly. These, indeed, for us, were great and most natural fears.
Well, I bet, Bill. Well, you know, did you have a plan?
And then a plan came into being. It was thought there ought to be a text. It was thought these ought to be backed up by stories. And this text was, in the first edition, 2/3 of the stories came from Akron.
All right. Well, there's a picture of Hank up there and a picture, and also a graphic of the original outline that he came up with, because you guys were really partners. And then you really, you didn't get any money from the Rockefellers, just enough to keep you going. And you needed to come up with some kind of a plan to keep you going so you could write. What did you decide to do?
So down east, we began to peddle stock in what turned out to be the AA book. But we were peddling stock to drunks, $25 a share. The purpose was what? To feed Wilson and the gal who helped do the book and the promoter and the collector of the money.
I told him how hungry you were. I see it says Works Publishing up there. Why did you call it Works?
The title was chosen because there would be a lot more work, you know, after this.
And then you put together what you called the prospectus, which there was a plan, and You were going to get 1/3 of the stocks because, after all, I mean, you were the writer, and Hank, he was going to get 1/3 of the stocks because, well, after all, he was the promoter. And you guys had to peddle the last 1/3 to the new guys and anybody that would listen to you. Tell us a little bit about the prospectus.
So in the prospectus, we totted up what the profits would be. Oh, I think we started in with something like 100,000 books, and you know, the first few carloads, and I think we got as high as 1,000,000 copies.
Jeez.
Well, of course, if they only cost 35 cents and you sold them for $3.50, it was would be, frankly, a great rise in that $25 stock. Might go to $1,000 a share. We didn't put all this on paper, but it was a part of the promotion.
Well, how did you pitch the drunks? What did you say to them?
We would sell these 35-cent books for the sum of $3.50. We didn't indicate any other expenses, but that seemed quite a margin of profit to the prospective stock buyer. And we pointed out that they couldn't possibly miss, because, after all, the digest piece with millions of circulation, in which they definitely would mention the new book, would simply move these volumes out in carloads while this job was being done. In other words, people were asked to buy stock in a book that hadn't yet been written. I think this is a world's record for sheer audacity.
Looking back, I do too. What was the reaction when people found out about this?
Well, this was heard out in this country, that this ex-Wall Street swindler was contriving one of the greatest rackets known to the mind man.
And what was the response?
Well, when this motivation began to be suspected and became apparent, quite a violent opposition rose up.
I bet. Well, what did you do?
So then we had only begun our troubles. Then the book had to be written.
So, did you start writing?
Well, I wrote another sample chapter and tried that on them. No stock purchases.
Oh, Bill. Well, that must have really upset the trustees. They were kind of antsy to get some money in there. How'd they take it?
And the trustees were very dubious. They had no money at the time, so we were able to face them down and say, well, we'll separately incorporate this. And sure enough, by an appeal to the loyalty of the stockholders to the cause, but also by an appeal to the pocketbook, the baser nature, the money began to dribble in, $25 par bet.
I know it was slow and hard, but then you were able to get back to the writing of the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
However, we were eating, a few of us, on the stockholders' money. And little by little, the chapters were evolved. And we thrashed them around in the AA meetings, and we carefully checked them with Dr. Bob as they went along. And meanwhile, he, at great pains and difficulty, got stories, largely from this town.
Boy, those guys didn't want to write those stories either. When they gathered around that dining room table to write them, thank God Jim Scott got sober just in the nick of time to help him out. And I know what you were doing. You would write a chapter, and then you would send it to Akron for feedback, and you'd also let the guys from Clinton Street look it over pretty well too. So it was quite a process. Bill, I know the night you wrote the 12 steps was a really tough night for you. You were pretty depressed, and we're all interested in that night. Would you tell us a little bit about the writing of the 12 steps?
In short, here was AA at its worst, but under God's grace, coming up with something better. Maybe history will say the best. And so the work went on, and I remember one night we got through the first four chapters, which were window dressing, and I was having an imaginary ulcer attack, and it looked like, things were very gloomy. The stockholders were kind of, falling down. The meal ticket was getting in danger, and I was very resentful. And I realized, lying in bed there in Brooklyn Clinton Street, that the book had to say what it was all about at some place. So I began to write, and out came the 12 steps.
You started with the 6 steps that you had written down previously that you pulled out of some of the Oxford Group teachings, and you thought that the alcoholic could fall through the cracks. So you really wanted to expand on them, and when you were all finished, you counted up that there were 12, and you were really happy about that number 12. You thought it was a pretty spiritual number, and you were excited to share that with the guys from Clinton Street. And what happened when you did?
Well, when they appeared, there was a terrific uproar. And as a result of the uproar, again, the constructive came out. I had had a great spiritual experience, so that I had used God all the way through those 12 steps.
Well, Bill, if you put all that God in there after your spiritual experience, there was quite a few agnostics in your group. What did they think about that?
Our atheist and agnostic contingent said, drunks don't go by that. They're scared to death of being God-bitten. This ought to be a psychological book.
Yeah, but if it was a psychological book, what would the religious people think?
On the other hand, the religious people said that it should be a strictly Christian book, theologically speaking. So one had to sort of average these point of view.
Well, you know, you were doing more than averaging. You actually got to the point where you said you didn't feel you were even writing the book. You thought you were umpiring it. And I know that Jimmy B. at that time kind of challenged you on that. And you settled on God as you understand him. And that you considered a 10 strike. And that's what's opened the door for people all over the world to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill. Do you think you had God's help?
Sure, we must have had God's help. We never could have produced it ourselves.
Well, with all that you've just shared with us, there's a lot of experience. Would you sum that up?
So this is the unholy way in which God nevertheless graced us in the days when AA was very young.
Well, thank you for that part of the story, Bill, but that's a whole other part comes when you go to publish it. We'd be interested in knowing what that part of the story is like. Would you tell us?
Well, finally the great day, our publication approached. We had pre-publication copies of the book made, circulated around for criticism, and with the last of our money, almost the last, we persuaded the printer that this was such a terrific venture that he certainly ought to accept a 10% down payment for 5,000 books, which were going out by the carloads, his first installment. So we paid him $500 for 5,000 books.
Wow, you talked him into that deal, huh? Well, I have a graphic up here of the prospectus that you sent out, the manuscript copy of the big book. You sent out about 400 of those, and you wanted people to write in them and send back so that you could get a working copy and find out how the clergy thought about this, and just all different types of folks, what their reaction would be. And you were told that you needed to get a doctor's opinion, so you went to your doctor, Dr. Silkworth, and he wrote the doctor's opinion. And then a lot of ideas came in. They told you to take the Oxfordizing out, and you began to work on that. And here we see a copy of the working manuscript that you and Hank used. We can see here that's pretty marked up, and that you had to put in the word we, and where there was Y-O-U-R, you can see it was crossed out, the Y was crossed out to make it our, and quite frankly, it was a mess. And it was such a mess that you had to accompany it to Cornwall. It was you and Hank and Ruth and Dorothy Snyder, Clarence's wife. You had to help them typeset it so that poor Ruthie didn't have to type it up again. And then what to call it? Well, it was going to be called the 100 Men Corporation. But then Florence Rankin got sober just in the nick of time, and she said, you can't call it 100 men. You got to call it 100 men and one woman. Thank you, Florence. And you wanted to call it the Bill W. Movement. We were already called the Alcoholic Squad in Akron. You were called a nameless bunch of drunks in New York. Dry Frontiers was considered Empty Glass, The Way Out. And then Joe Warden got out of the nut house just in time to play his part. And he was in the corner mumbling, Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics. And then he switched it around and he said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what did you think of that, Bill?
We'd been calling ourselves out there a nameless bunch of drunks, and from that the anonymity idea had come in. In fact, the book title, as voted by Akron, New York, and a few Clevelanders, was chosen as The Way Out. But in the Library of Congress, we'd found that there were 12 books by the name of The Way Out, so for heaven's sake, we couldn't make a 13th, so it became Alcoholics Anonymous.
Well, in Akron, we wanted to be called The Way Out. And if we'd have gotten our way, I could see the t-shirts now, we'd be called The Way Outers. And I'm glad we settled on Alcoholics Anonymous. They must have been running a special on red ink that day, because that big book is bright red.
Then we went up to the Digest.
Oh, okay,
and said,
go ahead.
Now, what about this piece? We're all ready to shoot. And the editor at whom we had talked vaguely remembered us, and he said, shoot what?
Oh, Bill, we're moaning with you. That must have been really shocking. You had sold all those stock certificates on that with the promise of the Reader's Digest. Well, what did you do?
Well, we reminded our friend that a piece was due, and he said, gee, Mr. Wilson, he said, you know, after you were here, I went to the rest of the staff here very sure that this would be a great piece, but they didn't think so, and I forgot to tell you.
Well, Bill, that had to be heartbreaking. What was it like for you?
So we had 5,000 books in the warehouse. There were 100 AA members. There were about 30 stockholders, and they each got a book. There were about 30 guys who put stories in the books, and they each got a book, and that was 60 books. So we only had 40 books to sell the rest if they'd buy it.
Well, that's when things got really, really tough. You and Lois are going to be homeless, and you're going to stay in people's cars, and things got really hard for you. Tell us about that.
Well, at that time, things folded up in a big way. We were about to be evicted from our house in Clinton Street. Stuff go into storage. The book was bankrupt, and we made one last great gasp effort.
What was that?
A drunk came along by the name of Morgan, who had been in the ad business, and he said, you know, I know Gabriel Heater. You know, the guy who puts on those wonderful sob talks. And he said, I think Gabriel would put this on the air. So we scared up a few dollars more. And to get ready for Gabriel, we decided...
Well, Bill, what's so funny? What did you do to get ready for Gabriel?
Well, we picked out a hard class of people to advertise to in those days. We picked out all of the physicians east of the Mississippi River, all of them. And to each one, we sent a postal card which said, listen to Gabriel Heater as he talks about the new Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. And buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous, A Cure for Alcoholism.
Well, I know you sent those all out, but wasn't there a problem with Morgan?
Well, one great trouble with Ryan was that he wouldn't sober up, and he was supposed to be interviewed on the air. My God, our last cent was in this thing and all these postal cards.
Well, what did you decide to do?
So just as a precaution, one of our friends who was a member of the Down Athletic Club said, well, now, you can have my room over there. I don't use it much. And why doesn't somebody live with Morgan in there the week before? you know, to just stay with him and be sure he gets the heater all right.
Well, that's some real control you guys were working on then. How did that work for you, Bill?
So the great day came. The postal card was out in Akron, New York, Cleveland. The ears were to the radio. We visioned the books going out in carloads, orders flooding in. Biggest profit of all in direct mail, no commissions. And sure enough, heater pulled out the tremolo stop. Ryan was sober. And boy, we were made.
Well, I know that was really an exciting time. And you had that post office box. Tell us about that.
We gave a post office box, old 458 in New York, I think it was, where we had a one-room office. Little Ruthie Hawk, who helped me with the book, bless her soul, my promoter friend Hank Parkes and I, just couldn't wait to get over to see what was coming into that box.
You held yourself back for 3 days before you went. Then you took suitcases because you wanted to be sure you could get them all back. So, but when you got there and you looked in the box, Bill, there wasn't too many cards in the box and your heart just sank. What was Hank's reaction?
Hank was an incorrigible optimist. He said, well, they couldn't put them all in the box. He said they got several mailbags full out there. So, the clerk came with the cards. Hank said, ain't there any more? No.
Wow.
We took them over to the desk and we counted them, and there were 12. And 10 of them were from doctors, obviously stewed themselves, who lambasted the hell out of us. And we had exactly 2 orders for the book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Wow. This is a tough story, Bill. You know, one minute you think it's going so right, and the next minute, you know, it falls apart on you. What did you learn from that?
For us, almost more than any other society, pain has been the touchstone of our spiritual progress. So we can say, thank God that we have suffered such pains, that such a spectacle as this has been brought into view and being.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for keeping on. Hey, Bill. Hey, say hello to Dr. Bob for us and thanks. I'm going to finish this story, as I was saying, for an anonymous fellowship. That red cover sure doesn't look anonymous, but check out this, what we call the circus jacket. Can you imagine walking down the street in the days where they were so anonymous with that big book under your arm that looked like that? One of the covers on the left was The Pathway to a Cure, and that same artist did that. And the first big book that came off the press is Bill's. And inside it he writes, note, this was the very first AA book off the press. We used thick paper to make sure the alcoholics felt they were getting their money's worth. Bill. Now I got to ask you, have you gotten your money's worth out of that book? All right. And you know, when Linda was talking about what it was like during Bob's drinking and during his sobriety as well, you can imagine what it was like for Lois. And so in the book to her, he says, to Lois, one whose loving care and fortitude in our dark days together made these pages possible. So to her, this first book of the first edition is lovingly and thankfully given Bill in memory of the fifth Christmas, 1225 of 39. And there's one little story that I want to tell that Bill doesn't tell, so I'm going to tell it. There was Bert the tailor, who owned a tailoring shop on Fifth Avenue, and they are so broke, and all these big books are in warehouses, and there's not anybody sober. Nobody knows about Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill already told you there's under 100 people sober, so these are just, you know, in hock. And there's a possible article coming out in Liberty Magazine, but they can't make it to the article. So they go to Bert the tailor, and they say, Bert, we need some money. Can you lend us some money? And Bert said, no, I can't. But he called up a friend of his, Mr. Cochran, who was a benefactor, and they pitched him, and they said, we'd like you to buy our books and put them in a in the libraries, and we would give you a dollar off. And Mr. Cochran said, well, send me your financial records, and I'll see. And he looked over our financial records, and he said, I don't think so. And so Bert said to Mr. Cochran, Mr. Cochran, will you lend me the money? And Mr. Cochran did. And Bert the tailor hocked his business to get us to this article. September 30th, 1939, Morris Markey writes an article called Alcoholics and God. And about 600 inquiries come in from that. But remember, 4,800 big books were printed up. That definitely helped, but it didn't get us out. What we didn't know is, remember that line where Mr. Rockefeller says, but let me know what goes on? Well, when the Rockefellers got involved with you, they didn't let go. They continued to follow. And Mr. Rockefeller decides that he would like to introduce us to his friends. So he holds a very special dinner. And some of the people that were at that dinner, he invites Harry Emerson Fosdick. He invites Dr. Kennedy. Of course, Bill Wilson was there. And quite an impressive list of bankers and important people in the country. Old Morgan Ryan was there. But Nelson Rockefeller presided because his father was sick. And actually, that wasn't supposed to happen like that, and I didn't mean to do that. The timing on that little guy running across the screen is a little off. Anyway, Nelson Rockefeller gets up, and Bill, again, they wanted money, and they thought they were close to it with all those rich people in the room. And Nelson stands up and says, my father thinks this is a work of goodwill, and money will ruin it. And now for that line, and Bill says, and with that, a couple billion dollars walked out of the room. Pretty disappointed, but we finally got the message. We finally decided to surrender. We took an oath of poverty. But after that event, 400 books were sold to Mr. Rockefeller for a dollar that he gave to his friends. Wouldn't you love to have one of those, huh? They typed up the proceedings of the event into pamphlets, and Mr. Rockefeller himself signed personal letters out to his friends. He didn't lend us money, but he lent us his name, which was a big help. Then along comes Jack Alexander, and he had been busting rackets, and he got the assignment to write about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thought we were a racket, so he came to bust us. He came to Akron, I believe he went to Chicago, but it's by attraction we promote. And that's when we learned that our friends can really help us. And we turned him around. And on March 1st of 1941, this little gal appears on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. 6,000 inquiries came in on that publication. And that's what really saved us. We ended up paying Mr. Rockefeller back. We're one of the few fellowships of our type that did that. And I already mentioned we took an oath of poverty. We don't accept outside contributions today. And that's just a little picture of our office. Letters are coming in from all over the country. And you know, this is kind of a hard story. So when you think of Bill sitting back here in his office, kicking back, or I love this picture here of the two of them. And I think what I like about this story so much is I think we all go through, what Bob say, our time in the barrel. Well, Bill and Lois certainly were in the barrel for a while. And we're often told in AA, don't quit before the miracle. And I think of this story and how hard things were for both of them and what they must be thinking right now. I mean, after being homeless and everything, standing in the office watching these big books being published all over and sent out all over the world. It's just such a sweet picture of the two of them. And Bill says in another talk that he gave in Texas, it transcended the mountain and the sea and is even at this moment lighting candles in dark caverns and on distant beaches. And now I ask you to just take a moment to reflect on this story. And I'm going to give a cast of characters. And as the cast of characters comes through, I challenge you to remove one name from this list, and I don't think we would be here celebrating this wonderful weekend. Bert Taylor, Abby, Bill, Lois, Jack Alexander, Mr. Cochran, Jim B., Henrietta Seiberlin, T. Henry and Clarice Williams, John D. Rockefeller, Hank, Albert Scott, Willard Richardson, Leonard Strong, Dr. Bob, Ann Smith, Ruth Hawk, and of course, all the credit will go to a higher power. Thank you.